Nuclear movies. The just-released Christopher Nolan film Oppenheimer, on the crucial years when physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer led the U.S. effort to develop the first atomic bomb, gets many things right. But some crucial points are wrong, especially its glaring omissions. For example, it's generally believed that beyond running the Manhattan Project and spearheading the efforts to design and build the first atomic bomb, Oppenheimer carried no responsibility after Trinity for how the bombs were used at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But then you listen to an author and filmmaker who has devoted more than 40 years to the study of the evolution of the atomic age, and as regards Oppenheimer's responsibility for Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he tells you,
he's always kind of pictured as the guy who, okay, helped make the bomb, but he didn't really have much to do with using it, getting it used. What could he do? You know, it's Truman, it's the generals and so forth. When in fact he did, he had a great deal to do with it. He was part of the targeting decisions. He was part of deciding how to use it, what elevation to use it at to cause the most damage. He was part of shooting down any proposals for a demonstration of the bomb. He was really the key person.
Well, when world expert author and filmmaker Greg Mitchell points out this and other details and missing perspectives in the new Oppenheimer film, you see all too clearly that the macro manipulations of image and perception in place from the start of the atomic age continue to cover up ongoing aspects of that dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a special program that focuses on the underlying messages of nuclear films, specifically the Oppenheimer film that just opened. We will have a very special interview with Greg Mitchell, an author and filmmaker who has spent the last 40 years focusing on atomic issues from pre-Trinity to the present. We share the same perspective on Christopher Nolan's film, Oppenheimer, and we'll provide you with a more nuanced review of the film and its content, as well as its omissions, than you'll find in mainstream media. We will also have Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter, and more honest nuclear information than even nuclear scientist Barbie has ever shared. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, July 25th, 2023, and here is this week's special on nuclear films, providing nuclear information from a different perspective. Starting out with Linda Pence Gunter on Nuclear Hot Seat's Hot Story, where she takes on the directors of two different recently released films on nuclear issues, Christopher Nolan and Oliver Stone.
This week's Hot Story is a tale of two directors. For one, it is certainly the best of times. For the other, probably the worst. Each took a single book as their inspiration and adapted it into a film. One made a blockbuster drama that garnered unprecedented advanced hype. Packing cinemas everywhere, it grossed $80.5 million in the US and Canada alone in its first weekend. The other made a documentary that grossed, $9,814 in the US and Canada over its first weekend. The average audience size for that film is apparently between 6 to 8 people. Both directors have bodies of work behind them that put them in the panoply of the greats, and both chose nuclear as their subject matter. Unless you are living in a remote cave somewhere, you know by now that the first film is Oppenheimer, directed by Christopher Nolan. It's essentially a dramatization of the life and career of J. Robert Oppenheimer, often referred to as the father of the atomic bomb. Nolan's film is based on the book American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer, a 2005 biography by Kai Bird and the late Martin J. Sherwin. If you haven't heard of the other film, you can be forgiven as it's clearly dying quietly in a corner. It's a documentary called Nuclear Now, directed by Oliver Stone, and based on the book A Bright Future by Joshua S. Goldstein. While the former is a triumph of cinematic storytelling and fine performances, the latter is by all accounts a dreary trudge along a well-worn and totally discredited pro-nuclear power propaganda path. I say by all accounts because I haven't seen it yet, but many of my colleagues have. So ironically, it's likely that about half of those 8 people per showing are probably anti-nuclear activists curious to see just how turgid and off-base Stone's film actually is. For fans of Stone, it was sad to see the old lion stumble so badly. Worse, that he's making the talk show rounds, spouting all manner of patently absurd and just plain wrong drivel. But in a way, he handed us an opportunity. If Nuclear Now is the pinnacle of the pro-nuclear lobby's achievement, they handed us an easy target full of holes to knock off the pedestal, allowing us to further educate people about the true detriments of nuclear power. Nolan's, though, is the greater gift. Yes, Oppenheimer doesn't tell the whole story from every perspective, especially the millions of victims of Oppenheimer's invention. Whether indigenous peoples mining uranium, those in the path of the 2,000 or so atomic tests, and especially those beneath the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But that's not Nolan's job, it's ours. Millions of people are now thinking about something they had chosen to ignore or forget, nuclear weapons. They will be asking themselves why we still have them, let alone invented them, and how we can get rid of them. Nolan has planted the horrors of nuclear weapons in the public conscience in a way that no amount of advocacy by our movement ever could. So thank you, Christopher Nolan. And thank you, Oliver Stone, as well. Opportunity has knocked. Now it's our responsibility to use it. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's Hot Story.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, it's nuclear anniversary time. The Trinity A-bomb test, Church Rock uranium tailings mine spill, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, those are just the anniversaries that run from July 21st to August 9, less than a month. And it's just the start. The list of nuclear dangers and disasters to commemorate is as endless as the quarter of a million years it takes for plutonium, present in all weapons and all nuclear reactor fuel rod waste, to lose its radioactivity completely. Every week, this show reports on stories of how the nuclear industry perpetuates itself despite the known risks. We get into nuclear stories with facts, continuity, and context, as well as a healthy dose of skepticism, providing a much deeper and nuanced telling than you would ever expect to find on mainstream media. But to keep doing this work, we need your help. This show runs on donations, so how about $5? The same as one would spend here in the U.S. for a nice cup of coffee and a tip to the barista. Or do it on an ongoing basis and buy Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of coffee a month. That would be a recurring donation of just $5. And, of course, you can always give much more than that on a one-time or an ongoing basis. Whatever you can give, your donation is crucial to us meeting our monthly nut. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit, which means that your donations are tax deductible. So go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to us at our email, info@nuclearhotseat.com. Don't delay and don't assume anybody else is doing it for you. Donate now. And know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Greg Mitchell is the author of a dozen books, including Hiroshima in America and Atomic Cover-Up, as well as the recent The Beginning or the End, about the first Hollywood film ever made about the atomic bomb. He's directed 3 documentary films since 2021, 2 of them for PBS, and he has written widely about the atomic bomb and atomic bombings, as well as their aftermath, for more than 40 years. We spoke on Friday, June 21st, 2023. Greg Mitchell, it's great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Well, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for welcoming me once again.
We're talking about the film Oppenheimer today, which both of us have just seen in pre-screenings. And first, let's get this out of the way. It's one hell of a movie as a movie.
Yeah, that's right. It's quite stunning, as many critics have said. The direction, the special effects, all the technical things, the acting, the technical writing of the script. So, you know, it should do well. I would advise everyone to see it, no matter what the feelings might be. But it's definitely a movie, but more, you know, especially in today's Hollywood, a lot more serious than most. And, you know, I applaud Christopher Nolan for taking it on, because I guess I'm a historian of Hollywood and the bomb. So I sort of know the failures in the past. So the fact he got this made is, you know, certainly kind of remarkable.
Agreed that you are not a typical viewer of the film, because you have written about Oppenheimer and World War II and the bomb over three books, hundreds of articles, and been doing this for dozens of years. But your focus has always been on the use of the bomb and its aftermath. What is different about the focus of this film, and what about its content and emphasis?
Well, it is, you know, what they call a biopic. It picks up Oppenheimer as a young man in college and goes through to the end of his life. So we do see him, the changes and decisions he made in college to pursue certain kinds of physics, and then his famous or infamous communist associations during the 1930s with his brother and his wife and his mistress, all members or former members of the party. And then he still somehow gets hired as the director of Los Alamos. Then we see the usual decisions that are made and breakthroughs in making the bomb, the usual focus on the Trinity test, and then not so much on the decision to use the bomb, not so much on the actual use of the bomb, not so much on the immediate aftermath of the bomb. We then jump ahead to the post-war and the decision to build the hydrogen bomb, which he mainly opposed, and then his problems later with losing his security clearance, the famous hearings during his 1954, and how that made him kind of a broke man. So for me, as someone who has read it all before or seen it all before, there really is not much new, and in some cases not stuff very good about the actual decision to use the bomb, and then the, you know, the aftermath of that, what lessons we should take from that.
Let's walk through that portion of it, because I think that's what's going to be most interesting to the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat. The purpose behind the Manhattan Project was to create an atomic bomb before the Germans did. That was the stated purpose. But it turns out, as we found once Germany was out of the war, that they were not working on a bomb. And on May 8, 1945, the country officially surrendered. What was the impact of that surrender on the Manhattan Project, since we no longer had Germany as the target for the bomb?
Right. Well, I just correct you on one thing. They were trying to build a bomb, but they didn't get close. And one reason they didn't get close was that so many of the brilliant Jewish scientists became refugees to the U.S. and were recruited for the Manhattan Project. So it's not really coincidental that Hitler could not succeed. But you're right. Once Germany surrendered, there was a change in mood among many of the scientists, not all of them, certainly, but a lot of the refugee scientists and others felt, okay, Germany's out, Japan's on last legs. Are we really going to use the bomb? I mean, you know, we thought it was, you know, Hitler was the big threat. Now Japan seems to be close to surrender. Do we really need to use it? Do we really want to use it? So that then became, as you said, from May 8th into July, became a focus of a good number of the scientists, including Leo Szilard, most famously, to try to slow or halt Truman from using it. Oppenheimer was not among them. So we can talk about how that is shown in the movie. But that's the basic terrain, what happened after May 8th leading to August 6th.
Not as regards the film, but as regards Manhattan Project. Only one scientist, Joseph Rotblat, left the Manhattan Project after that, and everyone else continued to work on it. For those who continued, was it a matter of, well, this is a scientific problem, we've come this far, let's see if we've solved the problem and we've really made the bomb? Or was there perhaps something else in operation?
Well, I think there was, understandably, and of course, Oppenheimer reflected this the most, but, you know, wanting to see if they could work. You know, they've done all this work. They had a number of breakthroughs. Could the bomb work? And, you know, naturally, people devote so much time, as sometimes their whole careers, to such things. I mean, it was an exciting project, unfortunate in some ways. And that's why Trinity is really the focus point of so many of these films. You know, like I said earlier, I've probably seen every movie about the bomb, certainly the project. And my book, The Beginning or the End, explores the very first A-bomb movie in 1946 from MGM. And Oppenheimer was involved in that and played kind of a sad role in helping to get that movie made. But that movie, you know, which I explore in my book, also has a lengthy, in some ways, a climactic Trinity scene. And every movie since then, there's only been four movies out of Hollywood on this. Same thing. They really focus on the Trinity test. And of course, the reason is that no one died at Trinity, at least immediately. Maybe some of the downwinders did later. So no one died at Trinity. So you can show all this great anticipation and success and excitement and visual effects of the bomb, you know, going off. And, you know, it's a triumph for Oppenheimer and the others. So it's this kind of guilt-free scene in any of these movies. So we see that again in Christopher Nolan's movie. Much, much more time spent on the testing, the test itself, and much less on the actual use of the bomb and, you know, what happened immediately after that.
Another factor that I've wondered about is that with $2 billion of government money having been spent on a project that really nobody knew about outside of a very tight, small circle of government officials, military men, and scientists. $2 billion, that's almost $34 billion in 2023 money. Could that have been justified if the bomb were never dropped, if the plug was pulled on the project because Germany was out and we no longer needed it?
Well, you know, that's one of the many interesting points about this and why one of things that's kept me interested and continuing to research for 40 years now is that there are an awful lot of angles to the story and an awful lot of things that have been proposed as explanations for why we went forward, including wanting to warn Russia about taking us on in the future and things like that. The money is a factor. It was cited by some of the people in pushing forward the test, making sure we did the test and making sure we used the bomb. It was cited in congressional testimony later, some admissions that, yes, we knew we'd spent a lot of money and wanted to help justify it. But there's no single explanation for that decision. You know, I think people who reduce it to one or two things, I think it's wrong. There were so many, not just personal motivations, individual people differing on this, why they were so enthused about it, to reduce it that much. But the fact we did spend that huge amount of money certainly was a factor. And okay, let's test it and then let's use it if we can. Certainly Oppenheimer was on board with that. Several things that the movie does not pay enough attention to is Oppenheimer historically in movies, going back to that Beginning or the End, the first movie that I wrote about, he's always kind of pictured as the guy who, okay, he helped make the bomb, but he didn't really have much to do with using it, getting it used. What could he do? You know, it's Truman, it's the generals and so forth. When in fact he had a great deal to do with it. He was part of the targeting decisions. He was part of deciding how to use it, what elevation to use it at to cause the most damage. He was part of shooting down any proposals for a demonstration of the bomb. He was really the key person because he was such an expert leading this project. And then he prevented the Leo Szilard petition from gaining more followers and, you know, ultimately getting to Truman in time for it to have some impact.
Explain what that petition was.
Leo Szilard, who was in Chicago, he was not in Los Alamos. He was, I suppose, the most activist in terms of feeling like we really shouldn't use the bomb. You know, we helped make it, but we don't really want to use the bomb, or there could be a demonstration. In any case, Truman should hold off, wait longer for Japan to surrender. So he wrote and circulated a petition that was signed by many dozens of scientists within the Manhattan Project. He thought would go to Truman in early July and could have some impact. Oppenheimer found out about it. And the movie shows, I think, maybe as many as three occasions, and this may surprise some people who know Edward Teller only as the father of the H-bomb and a rather bellicose figure in the 1960s and 1970s and 1980s. But actually, he was one of those people who was siding with Szilard and wanted to sign it and wanted to circulate it. But he made the mistake of going to Oppenheimer, telling Oppenheimer, and Oppenheimer discouraged him strongly. We see, I think, three brief occasions in the movie where Szilard kind of mentions to Oppenheimer, well, you know, I'd still like to sign this petition, you know, and Oppenheimer says, no, it's politics. This is politics. Politics is not our area, or we don't have any special expertise on decisions to use the bomb. You know, we're just scientists and et cetera. So the movie does cover that to some extent.
So Oppenheimer was involved with setting the parameters for the best, put the word best in quotes, the most effective way to drop the bomb on Hiroshima. Was he comparably involved in Nagasaki? Because as presented in the film, he was, if not surprised by Nagasaki, he was shaken by the fact that a second bomb had been dropped.
Yeah, he was in the same boat as a lot of people. And, you know, I talk about this a lot in my book. Unlike what most people probably think, they probably think, well, we bombed Hiroshima and then Truman gave a separate decision to use the second bomb and maybe he should have waited, but he made another decision. The planes took off. But, you know, the fact is we had sort of a atomic assembly line going at the time. The initial orders, which really came from General Groves, not even really from Truman directly, was, you know, use the bombs as soon as they're available. And the first one was available August 6th. There was no pause afterwards. No one said, let's see what the emperor decides. Let's hold off on Nagasaki. And in fact, one of the many tragic aspects of Nagasaki was that they were so anxious to use the bomb quickly that against all kind of orders or guidelines, the planes took off on August 9th in terrible weather. It looked like they went to the initial target, which was Kokura. It was covered in clouds. And it looked like, you know, they may have to ditch this, this $2 million weapon in the water. They went to Nagasaki and that was pretty much covered, but a small opening opened and they dropped the bomb. Because of that, the bomb was somewhat off target and not quite as many people died. But, you know, the fact is they wanted to use these weapons. Another thing that people often say as a explanation for why they were used is, well, we wanted to test both weapons. We used the uranium bomb in Hiroshima and the plutonium bomb in Nagasaki. The plutonium bomb became the weapon of choice. So that's what we wanted to do. We got both tests in. And again, it might have been a small part of this, but people who just reduce it to that, I think it's, you know, I think it's wrong. So there are so many reasons and explanations for why the bomb was used that, you know, we could talk all day about all these different angles. Most of them are plausible and interesting. I guess that's a long answer to your question. Did Oppenheimer have anything to do with the second bomb? And yes, he did, in the sense that he helped make the bombs and he didn't intervene to halt them. Again, the key thing was that in these targeting discussions, and this is, you know, I mean, as plain as day, there are records of this. I've written about it, so have others, that they decided in these targeting discussions that a demonstration would not work, and they would target the center of cities. And they used all kinds of language to try to suggest that they were military targets or mainly military targets, or were doing it because they're military industrial targets. But in reality, if you look at the actual minutes, the basic thing was, let's drop it on the center of cities, even though it's mainly civilians, because we have to show the pure scope of the destruction. If you bomb the center of the city, you'll probably show the whole or most of the city was destroyed. If you bomb a base that's next to it, off center, it's not going to be as effective. So they knew they were going to kill tens of thousands of civilians. There's just no question about it. I mean, that was part of the idea, you might say.
There's a scene in the movie that takes place about a month after the two bombings, where Oppenheimer meets with President Truman. And you've cited this in some of your recent writing, some of the blog posts I've seen. How accurate is the representation of that scene between the two men?
It's fairly accurate. One thing I have to say is that this movie, again, unlike previous movies, most of them, and certainly the beginning or the end, the first movie that I wrote the book about, is that it is really kind of remarkably accurate in most cases. I mean, I happen to know Kai Bird, who's been a longtime friend, and Marty Sherwin was a longtime friend who passed away. But they wrote the book that the movie is based on. And the movie actually bases itself on that book pretty well, I have to say. It's amazing how many things are taken almost directly from the book. So I would have to applaud Christopher Nolan for that. And this scene with Truman is, you know, it's fairly well known. It's been written about in the past, but, you know, basically about 2 months after Hiroshima, Oppenheimer had his first meeting ever with Truman, went into the Oval Office, and his so-called regrets or worries had time to build. Yeah, so he's talking to Truman. They get off on a bad start with certain exchanges. And then Oppenheimer kind of blurts out, you know, "Mr. President, I feel I have blood on my hands." Now, you know, I think there's a lot of interpretations of that. Some people have said, oh, that meant he has blood in his hands from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he is defended in most cases. I feel that the blood on the hands was more looking to the future. You know, I helped make these weapons. I helped them get used. And now I'm tainted because they're now going to be in the world and they could destroy the planet. I think that's what Oppenheimer meant, not that he had anything to do with that, that it really had to do with the carnage in Japan. In any case, Truman responded some version of, there's no recording of it, of, "Let me worry about that," or you didn't make that decision. Some people have a little melodramatically claimed that Truman took a handkerchief out of his pocket and gave it to Oppenheimer and said, "Here, wipe them off." And in the movie, he actually does take a handkerchief out, but he doesn't do anything with it. He just kind of holds it. But this actually happened. And then sometime later, Truman told an aide, I don't ever want to see this guy in here ever again. This actually happened. In the movie, it happens as Oppenheimer's still at the door. And again, in the movie, it has Truman saying to the aide or to Secretary Burns or whoever it's supposed to be, "Don't let that crybaby scientist ever come in here again." Now, Truman did use that expression, but it was in a letter sometime later. So, you know, that was, you might say, a typical Hollywood movie scene. It's essentially correct, but it's compressed. But crybaby scientist, I mean, I've seen the letter. It's there in print. This is what Truman's view.
There are certain omissions in the film that damage it for me in terms of the impact and the truthfulness of it. Given this is a Hollywood film, they have to do what they do to make it palatable to people. But from the start, from Trinity onward, the word radiation is never used in the film. I think there's one reference to something like radioisotope particles. I think that was the term that was used when they were showing off screen, which we never saw the pictures of the people from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But with this omission of radiation, how does that damage our understanding of the true ongoing impact of any of these weapons?
Well, it's a rather significant omission. This was, of course, a revolutionary aspect of this new bomb. The scientists, including Oppenheimer, knew there was going to be a big radiation release. In fact, they were most concerned with being able to tell the pilots of the planes to get the hell out of there as soon as possible after they dropped the bombs, because they'd be in a radioactive cloud. And that's the biggest step they took. They did not evacuate the nearby villagers. They did not warn them in any way. And then they lied to them afterwards, after there was a large radioactive cloud that drifted and dropped the particles, and, you know, livestock died. There's the famous story of the donkey who literally was paralyzed, lost hair. The horses, you know, lost hair and fur and so on and so forth. And then people later seemingly developed cancers and so forth. So the story of radiation was rather significant. But again, they don't want to introduce that with Trinity, because Trinity is a high point. You know, you could say Trinity is the high point of the film, in the sense, okay, they managed to build this weapon and test it and it was successful. Well, God, we don't want to show people getting, exposed to radiation and so forth. And then, of course, going forward, what I would call the twin evils of radiation, lethality and secrecy associated with it, became so much a part of our policy and tragedy for decades after, where radiation effects were hidden, soldiers were exposed to radiation, to radioactive particles, fallout, in all those bomb tests in Nevada and in the Pacific. Downwinders, people who lived downwind from the blast, were seriously affected, and workers in nuclear plants. You know, I mean, you can go on and on. We had medical tests that were covered up for decades, where we actually did medical tests with radiation on people who didn't know they were being tested. So it's just a sad, horrible history of the effects of radiation in our history, but also the growth of the incredible national security secrecy state, partly because of secrecy around nuclear weapons and around radiation and all these programs. So we had, coming out of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we had, beyond what you could just want to say about the effects of the bomb and how many people died and did we have to use it and everything, you also have the actual beginning launch of this national security secrecy and nuclear state that went on for decades, and of course a horrible arms race and so on and so forth.
We're still dealing with that cover-up of radiation today and the manipulation of its impact, basically being told that there isn't any when indeed there is. And that's a whole other topic. One of the great omissions in the film is that we never see what actually happened on the ground to the Japanese people. We see none of the destruction, which was by policy and by fiat by General MacArthur, who was controlling things on the ground. Pictures were not allowed to be taken of people, only of the physical destruction of the rubble that was there. And in the film, we never see what happened to the people. All we see is Oppenheimer in very extreme close-up while a narration is going on about these radiological particles, or whatever the phrase was that they used. And he is, when you hear the slides changing, you see him flinching with great discomfort. But we as audience members never get to participate in that discomfort. We never get impacted from it. Had they chosen to go there, what difference do you think it might have made to the reception of the film, the power of the film, its impact on people's thinking about the bomb?
Well, it's a good question. And I should say, as you know, I've made a whole film recently about this cover-up of film footage after Hiroshima called Atomic Cover-Up. You can certainly find the trailer and a great deal about it online if you search Atomic Cover-Up. It's about that very subject of the U.S. suppression of both the black and white and color footage from Hiroshima. Of course, Christopher Nolan is not bound by that in 2023. And you're right, there are really only two very brief scenes where you might say you get a little bit of the flavor of that, if you will. The first one is when Oppenheimer celebrates the successful use of the bomb to stomping, clapping Los Alamos staffers. He comes out like a prize fighter, clasps his hands over his head and says something like, "I don't think the Japanese are too happy tonight," or something like that. Again, very accurate. You know, this scene actually happened. But then Nolan just then adds about 60 seconds where Oppenheimer has one of his many visions that he kind of has in the movie. And in this vision, he actually sees a young woman whose face looks burned very briefly. And then his foot steps in something black, very kind of hard to tell what it is. Some sort of black object. I still don't know if it's supposed to represent a burnt victim, like a log, or just the dark night of the soul. I don't know. It was so hazy. The screen was shaking. The noise was building. It's a vision Oppenheimer's having, and it lasts about 45 seconds. So I still don't know what was happening in that scene. And the other scene is, as you say, they just suddenly and totally out of sequence, and I'm not sure why it was injected, but you see Oppenheimer in kind of a screening room from the side. And again, maybe 45 seconds, 30 seconds, he's looking at a screen, which you can't see. And some narrator is saying something about, and the people of Hiroshima are, I thought Nolan would kind of cover himself there by having the narrator saying, and, you know, and so many women and children died, and, you know, the living envied the dead, and people were dying of this mysterious new disease in hospitals by the thousands, and et cetera, et cetera. But there's none of that. There's this very bland, vague narrator for, you know, 30 seconds. And we see Oppenheimer watching the screen, and that's it. And then, of course, Oppenheimer in the rest of the film does offer these kind of vague, conflicting, ambiguous, ambivalent regrets about something. Again, it's always hard to tell what he is offering regrets for, but those regrets carry an awful lot of burden in this story. Somehow his haunted face, haunted eyes, and some of the words he uses are the only thing that's, you know, would make an audience member wonder about the decision to use the bomb. I mean, I had a piece that just published in Mother Jones. I would recommend people find it. And in it, I talk about how the film, if anything, sustains the official narrative of Hiroshima that I've kind of taken on for 40 years now. Because in the film, we get to this, again, largely accurate meeting of the interim committee advisors to Truman, who take up the question of, well, should we use the bomb? One or two of the people in the meeting say, well, do you really think we need to use it? Japan seems like it's defeated. Maybe we should do something else. And I can't remember who the character was now. I think he was a military officer, although he might not have been. He might have been a secretary of state or something. Says, and this has been the official Hiroshima narrative from the beginning, is if we don't drop those bombs, you know, we're going to have to invade and hundreds of thousands of our soldiers will die. And only the use of the bomb will prevent that. And then he even says, and if we had a demonstration, they could shoot down the pilot or whatever. And then they actually, Nolan's hokey moment, has one of the other characters there interject, yeah, and I might be flying that plane. That part, I don't know if is accurate, I have to tell you. And no one contests that. Oppenheimer doesn't contest it. And then the bombing happens. Nobody says anything. And then we move on with, again, Oppenheimer's vague regrets about something or other. And so to me, it may be that people will come out of the movie. Let's admit, a great number, if not most people who will see this movie, have not been exposed to much of this history. They may have even heard of Oppenheimer. Polls show that a great number of Americans think Russia dropped the bomb on Japan. You know, the fact is a lot of people are going to come to this really unencumbered by history. And I feel that most people who watch it would say, what is Oppenheimer wringing his hands about? He seems like he's regrets something. But, you know, all we've seen in the movie is this standard and powerful and, you know, well-stated explanation that we have to use these two bombs and they're the only thing that can end the war quickly. And we have to use both of them. And nobody says a word about it afterwards. Like, well, maybe we really didn't. Here's some other evidence. Russia was about to enter the war. We could have waited a few days for Russia. The impact of Russia's invasion. We could have let Japan keep their emperor. You know, we wanted unconditional surrender. We wouldn't let them keep their emperor after we dropped the bomb. We did let them keep their emperor. The invasion wasn't scheduled for 3 months. A lot could have happened in 1 week, let alone 3 months. None of that is in the movie. So what I'm afraid of is that, yes, people will come away with a sense that something was wrong because Oppenheimer seems to be haunted by it, but you're going to be left more confused than ever, I think, by sort of feeling, well, why is he regretful? You know, they ended the war, the bombs ended the war and saved American lives. And what's his problem?
Was there any place where the film just got something dead wrong?
Boy, that's a good question. Like I said, I think I can praise the accuracy of the movie. I think I can praise the fact that it does end with a powerful message. And it is more, Nolan is more concerned with 2023 than 1945. And maybe that's the way it should be. I'm grateful for any focus on getting rid of nuclear weapons today and controlling them. And that is the message at the end of the film. But my problem is that that's all well and good. But as long as we're making two exceptions to their use, you know, it's sort of like everyone says, well, we should never use them again, or nuclear weapons must never be used. But the fact is, most in the media, many historians, certainly officials, U.S. presidents, military people, most of them continue to endorse, sometimes strongly endorse, the use of the two bombs in 1945, the two exceptions. And then they'll turn around and say, we must never use nuclear weapons again. And the fact is that America today, as we always have, has a first use policy, first strike policy, as it's known, which means every president has the ability or is enabled or is allowed to order a nuclear strike in response to a conventional attack from abroad or even a threat from abroad or a major crisis. And so in a way, we're kind of, by making two exceptions in another situation where we struck first and against an enemy that did not have nuclear weapons, you know, we've laid the groundwork for that, because that has not been refuted or even questioned by many people. And I'm sure you've probably seen that great fears, great dangers and threats have risen during this Ukraine war. You know, Putin more than once loves to say, when the U.S. lectures him on, you know, not using nuclear weapons, he said, well, you're the only country that has used them. You know, you use them twice. What are you doing lecturing me to not use nuclear weapons? So it's a bad lesson for the world today. So it's not, it's just a story of the past. You know, it's not, you can say, well, we can't bring back the dead. We can't reverse that decision. But we can look at that decision in a different light and sort of say, like, that was not, you know, the last resort. If that had been on the verge of an invasion, it might have been a different story. But was this really the having to use those weapons as a last resort, or was it desirable? It wasn't necessary, but it was desirable. It was desirable to get these weapons used. So I think that's the, that's what it comes down to. And I think seeing the movie, I think people will have mixed emotions, you know, kind of applauding it in many ways. And then maybe not even till afterwards to think about, you know what, it's right. We didn't really see this. I'm not sure if this was clear.
You and I both saw Oppenheimer in advanced screenings, you in New York with a panel that included the director. I saw it last night in Los Angeles with a panel discussion presented by Plowshares Fund and included representatives for Physicians for Social Responsibility and Moms Against Santa Susana Field Lab. So the audience that was attracted to it was highly motivated, self-selected, and probably more educated than most. That's my guess.
Okay.
We had some pretty strong discussions, both during the panel discussion and after the movie. How was it received, to your perception, after New York?
Oh, well, it was a completely different thing. It was only 120 people. It was billed partly as a tribute to, but they were marking the Trinity anniversary of the Trinity test. There were three Nobel Prize winning, three scientists on the panel, including the current director of Los Alamos with Nolan. So there were no questions from the audience. And the discussion was very much, I would say rah-rah, but it was very much, look what a great job Nolan did with the physics, presenting it. You know, he was a great student of instruction we helped give him. But Nolan, the main thing Nolan, and it did get some press, there were a lot of stories inspired by this. He talked a lot about the current threat of AI and comparisons. He even said he talked to many Silicon Valley people and others who refer to the current problem as their Oppenheimer moment, the great little phrase. This is our Oppenheimer moment. And I presume what they mean is the genie's out of the bottle here on AI. And their question is whether how much to work on it, how much further to go, should they quit and not help develop it even further? So it's an interesting modern spinoff of this. So I'd like to have people watch this movie and say, yes, I shouldn't do that. And I think some people may, because we do see right to the final scene, haunted Oppenheimer, warnings about the future. And so I think some people will come away like, this was not a great, great idea to bring this weapon into the world, and I should back off on the AI research.
Obviously, the launch of this film and the attendant publicity, which has been enormous, has blasted a hole, so to speak, in people's lack of awareness of nuclear issues and the fact that there is something here to examine and discuss. How might activists harness this sudden surge of interest in Oppenheimer and the bomb and use it to leverage and reinvigorate the anti-nuclear movement?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. You know, I go back, we've seen this movie before, except that wasn't a movie. It was Jonathan Schell's The Fate of the Earth book in 1981, which really did help launch the great anti-nuclear movement of the early 1980s and the Freeze campaign and so forth. Now, this was a book that excerpts first appeared in The New Yorker, and then it was passed hand to hand, and the book became a bestseller. And it appeared at a time when there had been a lot of years of quiet on this issue. And it sparked, I mean, directly sparked the formation of Physicians for Social Responsibility and all the different groups that have social responsibility after their names. that came out of this, and then widespread posting in newspapers and magazines of blast circles, you know, where you live. If they just dropped one hydrogen bomb today, this would be the circle of destruction. So if you lived in Detroit, you could see, even if you lived in the suburbs, you'd be doomed. So this one book had a tremendous effect. And we also saw this in 1946 with the publication of John Hersey's New Yorker article and book Hiroshima. And again, I get into this in my book, The Beginning or the End, because this article had such an impact that the MGM movie of that name that I write about was one of several reactions that aimed to put down the concerns raised by the Hersey article. So the number of things had to be done so the John Hersey article did not have as much impact as it looked like it was going to have. So I would say these are the two main comparisons in terms of something in the arts that had a tremendous popularity and potential impact. Now, the question is whether Oppenheimer as a movie, as a Hollywood movie, as a 3-hour Hollywood movie that's up against Barbie, you know, people seem to be more excited about Barbie. So that's America today. That's younger people today. We'll see what happens. But I'm cynical enough to wonder if the impact that Oppenheimer would have. I'll just say one other thing, which is that one thing that has definitely already happened with the anti-nuclear activists is we've seen a number of articles about the downwinders. That's sort of the biggest thing I've seen so far, is that the movie has sparked a lot of more attention on the downwinders, people who were affected then and now, you know, people who are still fighting for recognition on what the bomb caused and in tests. So that's the only thing I could say so far that I've seen, that a big upsurge in interest in the downwinders.
Actually, Barbie seems to be boosting Oppenheimer because millennials are deciding, ooh, let's see a double bill. And they're calling it Barbenheimer.
Yeah, well, we'll see how many will see the double bill or not.
Or if they'll sit through it to the end.
We'll know what the box office results soon. Again, I do wonder the 3-hour movie on this subject, how many people, and I know a lot of people were excited to see it in IMAX, you know, so the people talk about all these sold out screenings. They're largely talking about IMAX screenings, but, you know, the vast majority of people will not be going to IMAX. So I think that's the question. The average moviegoer, are they going to go out to the mall and see this movie? I hope so.
Is there anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to add at this time?
I would just say that the history of Hollywood, again, I wrote a piece for the LA Times this week about the 4 movies that have come out of Hollywood, including The Beginning or the End. If people want to find the LA Times story, they can. I'm doing a daily blog newsletter called Oppenheimer from Hiroshima to Hollywood on Substack. I'm going to keep doing that for at least another 3 weeks every day. You know, I'm sticking with this at least through Nagasaki Day, as I do every year. And I just think in my stories and a lot of others, you know, in writing about this so much, you're bound to find things you never knew, things you can't believe, things that, you know, gee, I didn't know that. And I think it takes that kind of close attention to history and details to bring these things out and try to have lessons, real lessons for today, and not just like, well, it's over and done with, or, you know, people even turn the page on movies. I'd like to think Oppenheimer, well, if I came back 3 weeks from now, we could talk about this again, and we'd be talking about, wow, boy, the Oppenheimer movie really created a sea change. And let's talk about all the things that have been going on the last 2 or 3 weeks. But I'm skeptical that that's going to happen. I'll come back in 3 weeks if you want and talk about the talk about this mountain, this amazing impact that Oppenheimer had. I have a feeling it's not going to be necessary, but I'll happily come back and talk about this turning point in American history that Oppenheimer created.
You're on, and I will follow up on that. Greg Mitchell, you've been doing stupendous work for a long time on these issues with great clarity, fidelity, and a wealth of information that seems to escape most other journalists. So I want to thank you for your work and for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you. Always happy to be here.
Author and filmmaker Greg Mitchell. We'll have lots of links up to Greg's work, including the Oppenheimer Daily Newsletter blog, which is free, his books, The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, and Atomic Cover-Up, about the long-suppressed newsreel footage of Hiroshima and U.S. military footage of Nagasaki in the immediate aftermath of the bombs. All of that, plus a link to our previous interview with Greg about Atomic Cover-Up, will be on our website, nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 631. Here's today's final thought. Much like Greg Mitchell, I spotted the omissions in Oppenheimer and filled in the missing pieces for myself. Easy to do after more than 12 years of producing Nuclear Hot Seat every week. When the explosion was shown at Trinity, I flashed on individuals I've met and interviewed for this program, mostly Native people who lived as close as 30 miles from the blast in Socorro and Tularosa Basin, New Mexico. Some of them were alive in 1945 and saw the bright flash of light in the sky, but neither they nor their families had any idea what it was. They were told, the official line, that it was a munitions dump explosion, nothing to worry about, and so they didn't know to take any precautions and didn't. As the film showed Oppenheimer and the scientists celebrating, my thoughts went to the children who saw white flakes falling from the sky, drifting down after the blast, and played with it like it was snow instead of deadly radioactive fallout, including those still living but so contaminated by the radioactivity that their flesh could not be eaten by the very people who depended upon them for food as part of a traditional way of life. I thought about the cloud of radioactive fallout that floated away from the site into what we now know are 46 states plus Canada and Mexico. If you live anywhere in the lower 48, chances are you or your genetic upline, parents or grandparents, were exposed to it. I thought about the downwinders who are still fighting to be acknowledged for the harm done to them and compensation owed, going back 78 years to Trinity and including the Nevada test site. Even those who lived close to the site in New Mexico are still fighting to be included in the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. One consistent point from those earliest days reflected in the film is that the words radiation and radioactivity are not even mentioned. Indeed, much of the early days and years of the atomic age, as it came to be known, were devoted to suppressing any information on radiation, thus paving the way for all kinds of nuclear incursions into otherwise normal life and the consistent denials of radiation dangers. From the radioactive tritium in Fukushima's wastewater to suburban homeowners in North St. Louis raising children not knowing that the picturesque adjacent stream was contaminated with Manhattan Project waste, to Simi Valley in California where moms watched their children sicken and sometimes die of cancer before they learned that their upper-middle-class homes were built next to the Santa Susana Field Lab, a wasteland riddled with leavings of nuclear weapons production, and in so many other locations. Long-absent explosions or even the manufacture of nuclear materials, the radiation released continues to do what radiation is going to do, none of which is healthy for people or the environment. The one defining characteristic of atomic or nuclear weapons is that they kill twice, once in the fireball, shockwaves, and heat from an initial explosion, and forever from the slow, silent, invisible spread of illness and death caused by radiation in our food, the dust in the air. Oppenheimer knew. All those scientists knew about radiation. But this information was suppressed. The one time it was revealed, in a British newspaper, in an article written by an Australian journalist who managed to find his way to Hiroshima before the MacArthur crackdown and lockdown of access, he could only report on what he saw without understanding the scientific context and thus called it an atomic plague. But Groves, MacArthur, and the entire military, industrial, political establishment destroyed the credibility of that article, and with it, any lingering claims of radioactive damage to the Japanese people, the environment, or for many years beyond. And indeed, in Oppenheimer, the entire subject of radiation is as invisible as radiation itself. The other glaring omission of the film is the lack of any visuals of the damage done to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, not even shots of the rubble, which was the only aspect of the bomb's effect that MacArthur would allow to be photographed. Absolutely no pictures were allowed of the people who had been burned, who had been killed, who were still dying from the radiation. In the film, we hear the click of slides being changed as a narrator uses a term other than radiation. I think it was radioisotope or something like that. And what we're seeing is an extreme close-up of Oppenheimer as he flinches from the presumably painful images he's seeing. But we, the audience, never get a chance to see what he is seeing. And that leaves an ultimate hole in the movie. Those of us who know the photos of horrific harm done to people in both Japanese cities can fill in the blanks from images that are burned into our psyches. But for most of the moviegoers, especially the younger ones, they will not know. And as Greg Mitchell so powerfully pointed out in our interview, we're left with a narrative that the bomb saved American lives and ended the war, with no mitigating information that pointed to the complexity of the issues and alternative scenarios that might have ended the war long before a planned American invasion that fall. Taking these other factors into account, we didn't need to incinerate 200,000 Japanese people. So Oppenheimer is a technically superb movie. As far as history goes, it's a good movie. But it chickened out on the two key points that would have made it a great, world-changing movie. The tragic nature of what those scientists unleashed upon the world never landed. And for younger generations who are just now learning a narrative of those times, the full tragic disaster that was created remains as invisible as radiation itself. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 25th, 2023. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week so you don't miss a single episode, we make it so easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, look for the yellow box, put in your first name and an email address, and shazam! Every week you will get one email, just one, with the link and a short description of the show's content. By signing up that way, you also help us with Google algorithms. So go ahead, do it now. And if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything at all will be greatly appreciated. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023. Libby Halevi and Hartistry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as you cite the program, the website, the name of any guest whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that the original name for the Trinity Atomic Test Site in New Mexico is Jornada del Muerto, which in Spanish means Day of the Dead. Indeed. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.